X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Expands consciousness. Wow, what 2 weeks it has been. Sorry I missed Easter Sunday. I figured most of you did too, so we ran an archive from last year. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. This is where the past meets the future, right here at X Squared Radio. So glad you could tune in and get squared. We're live at 5 on the West Coast, here for the fastest 3 hours in webcast radio. Tons of news to go over tonight. We want you to be part of the program, so the call-in number is 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Also, in a very few moments, the conference line will be cranked up. That means that you can walk around with an informed smile on your face. By just dialing in this number, you can hear the program, but you can't interact with it unless you hang up and call in. 760-569-7676. And the passcode is 192919#. Also, as promised, Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty, went into print today. We'll be out on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and everywhere fine books are sold, as well as our website, alienatednation.com. However, because you are a faithful BBS radio listener here at xsquaredradio.com, you will be able to buy the book at a discount for 24 more hours. That's right. Normally $14.95, you can still get it for $9.95 for 24 more hours. Tomorrow night, it will go live at the regular retail price of $14.95. Now, not only do you get the autographed paperback, but you also get the audio version for free. It will be finished. I've been pushing the schedule, but as promised, it went into print April 15th. All I could tell you is you better wear gloves when you read this book. It's hot. I mean hot. AlienatedNation.com. Also, our good friends down at Power Places have thrown a lot of compliments our way. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much for clicking more than 200 times on the Maya 2012 conference banner. Excellent, excellent work. Great. Globally, we've had people all over the world click on that banner from xsquaredradio.com. Now, that being said, not very many of you have signed up for the conference. I gave you plenty of time, 12 months, to get ready for this. It's plenty of time. You need to see yourself there. Yes, it is not the cheapest conference in the world, but it is going to be the greatest. You can meet me in Houston. We will go down together to the Yucatan, and we will be from the 13th to the 22nd of December at Chichen Itza. That's ground zero for 2012. Some of the world's best speakers are going to be there. This will be life-changing. So I implore you to get your reservations in, because this will fill up this summer. I know it takes some planning, but you just have to make the commitment and see yourself there. If you don't like flying, or you don't have a passport, or what is that? Excuses number 6 and number 11, right? That's okay. That's okay. Because we have the Pythagoras Conference coming up in October. You can click on the blue Pythagoras Conference banner at xsquaredradio.com, get $100 off, and you don't have to fly anywhere, and you don't have to have a passport. I don't even think you have to have ID. But it's in the Midwest, southern Indiana, 50. of the top world speakers in this genre. And it's in the Midwest. That's cool because you don't have to fly all the way to the West Coast. You are within usually one day drive of Southern Indiana. You need to be there. It's going to be a blast. One or the other, or both. Come on. This is 2012. This is the year we've all been waiting for. The dawning of the age of Aquarius. Anyway, we're glad you're here with us tonight. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much for 100th Monkey. Ramon has come out with a new book. We're going to interview him in a couple of weeks about that. I haven't started it. I read the back cover, but I told you I've been really busy this last week. You know, I had to get the book out. The book's gone to the publisher. It's in print. So now I have some time to read somebody else's book. But thank you very much for 100th Monkey for creating a year-long legacy that will never be forgotten. You guys stay at it. We're so glad that you're building audience and all those wonderful listeners are on when we come on the air, and hopefully we can keep the fire burning. The solar wind tonight is cooking pretty well at 415.4 kilometers per second, and there are no sunspots to report today, but that does not stop the sun from lashing out into space. The NOAA forecasters estimate a 25% chance of strong geomagnetic storms around the poles this week. As CME delivers a glancing blow to Earth late last week, and a cloud was propelled in our direction by a solar filament. We've discussed solar filaments on this program. They're like giant magnetic rubber bands, and when they snap, they just lash out into space with very high velocity coronal mass ejections. Well, a potentially significant active region, and this thing is like a 200,000 mile tall tornado. Yeah, imagine that on the sun. It is an active region. It's about to rotate onto the Earth side of the sun. It is a hot plume of plasma flying over the sun's northeastern limb, heralded by its approach during the early hours this morning. The eruption hurled a coronal mass ejection toward NASA's Stereo B spacecraft. Fortunately, it wasn't pointed right at Earth. Analysts at the Goddard Space Weather Lab have prepared a forecast track showing the progress of the cloud. No planets are currently in the line of fire, but we will keep you posted. Earth is approaching the debris field of Comet Thacher. I know. Who knows about that? Come on. It's a source of the annual Lyrid meteor shower. Now, normally these are not much. I mean, you'll see a few, maybe a few more than on normal nights. But forecasters expect the shower to peak this week, starting around tonight. And it will probably peak in about 6 days or 7 days between now and next Sunday. We don't know exactly which day, but if you have a chance to go night gazing, dark sky trips, I would take them this week. A nearly new moon this week will make perfect dark sky conditions for meteor watching. Usually the shower is mild, about 10 or 20 meters per hour, but unmapped filaments of dust in the comet's tail sometimes trigger outbursts 10 times stronger. So you could see anywhere from 100 to 200 meteors per hour. That is about 1 a minute, so hang in there. Also, if you want to get out there tonight with your refracting scope, not really a reflecting scope, that's one with a mirror, doesn't really do too well on planets. They're more for viewing constellations and nebula, but you need a good refracting scope because tonight, and it's going to be an awesome night for this, Saturn is at opposition. That means it's directly opposite the sun in the skies of Earth. The ringed planet means it's very bright, and the ringed planet rises at sunset and soars high in the sky at midnight. So it's up all night long. This is the time when Saturn's rings are at their best. They're not, you know, straight on. From the point of view of Earth, shadows in the ring plane almost completely disappear, just as your own shadow tries to hide beneath your feet at noon. And sunlight is directed directly backscattered by the icy ring's particles toward our planet. So you can really, really see them clearly. It's not so much flat waves where you really can't see them. Also, you know, we've talked about drones on this program because, I don't know, it's kind of like Cyberdyne Systems on steroids. We really are fascinated by the idea of robotic warfare because over the last few decades, the folks down at Wars R Us have done their best to try to depersonalize warfare. That is to say, you know, in the old days, back when we were riding horses, or maybe just before that, we would charge across the misty tundra at each other with battle axes and swords and clubs, and we would hack and beat each other to death at close range. You know, I'm talking about major war trauma, okay? Because, you know, you don't go out there in silence and do this. Everybody's screaming and yelling, and there's injuries, and there's, well, come on, it's not a video game, all right? The sun rises, and you go out and try to stay alive until the sun goes down. Seriously? Are you seriously? I mean, that's like playing football for 12 hours. Nobody can do that, and yet that's what armies did. And then we got a little less personal. We got longer range weapons. We got arrows. We got ballistas. We got bullets, and we got cannons. And then we got airplanes where we could kind of drop bombs and not really hear anybody yelling about it on the ground. Now what we have are drones, and we have infrared signatures. We have forces that are attrited rather than slaughtered. We use much more mathematical words about it. And with the drones, it's a matter of sitting nice and safe at Nellis Air Force Base with a joystick in your hands, or better yet, just a mouse, and you just click on the targets, and the drone or the eye in the sky figures everything out, and the drone just optimizes its pathway and goes and takes people out. And it's getting better and better. A lot of these drones can stay up for 14, 15 hours at a time, sometimes 24 hours. And they're very quiet and they're very stealthy up there in the sky. The only way to really know that they're up there during the day is to look down. Yeah, down at the ground, because they don't block the, they block the sunlight, okay? So that means they make a shadow on the ground. So they put spotter planes up like a little Cessna or something, and they go out over the desert where it's, you know, nice clean sand, or at least they can see a long, long way on the ground in bright sunlight, and they just look for shadows going across the ground. It doesn't matter if radar picks it up or not. You can see it because it does the sunlight tends not to go through these things. They're not transparent. But in any case, a conventionally powered MQ-9 Reaper drone. Who sits around and names these things? You know, the Reaper. What do you do for a living? I build Reapers. Yeah, baby. Holy crap. Anyway, it has a flight time of 14 hours when loaded. It could fly far longer with nuclear energy. That's right. Back in 1955, my good friend and colleague, Stanton Friedman, was on a team to research the feasibility and application of a nuclear-powered jet. Yeah, a jet that ran on nuclear energy, literally could stay in the air for years. Well, you don't see them in the sky, do you? Right. Because they weren't feasible, okay? The containments were risky. Having a reactor flying around up there at 40 or 50,000 feet, not too bright. Anyway, American scientists have drawn up plans for a new generation of nuclear-powered drones capable of flying over remote regions of the world for months on end without refueling. Cyberdyne Systems, here we come. The blueprints for these new drones, which have been developed by Sandia National Laboratories, you know where that is, right? That's right. Our good friends out there at Wars R Us, Palo Alto, Sandia. Of course, they do have technology transfer, but I doubt they're transferring this technology to the civilian world. The U.S. government's principal nuclear research and development agency and defense contractor, Northrop Grumman, has designed this to increase flying time from days to months while making more power available for operating equipment, according to a project summary published by Sandia. You'll remember about 21 months ago, Sandia published a paper saying that they had performed experiments with a dimensional motor. That's right, a dimensional motor. They published in their paper that they could, with this motor, propel a craft from Earth to Mars in 8 days. It currently takes 98 days to get to Mars. 8 days with this dimensional motor. We haven't heard anything about that. We haven't seen any further development of that. But this is the kind of work that comes out of Sandia Labs. Pretty incredible stuff. This is a pretty terrifying prospect, said Chris Coles of Drone Wars UK. I like the name of that company. I'm going to see if we can get somebody from that company to come on the program, which campaigns against the increasing use of drones for both military and civilian purposes. Drones are much less safe than other aircraft and tend to crash a lot. There is a major push by this industry to increase the use of drones, and both the public and government are struggling to keep up with the implications. And there are a lot of them. You know, just this last week, we had a Navy jet land in an apartment complex in South Carolina, or maybe North Carolina. But no one was hurt, fortunately. The pilot dumped all the fuel before he let the plane go down. The highly sensitive research into what is termed ultra-persistence technologies. I told you, they're so antiseptic with this. And they'll probably come up with an acronym, the UPT, Ultra Persistence Technologies. It sounded like, you know, my mother. She was ultra persistent. Yeah. Anyway, set out to solve three problems associated with drones: insufficient hang time over a potential target, lack of power for running sophisticated surveillance and weapons systems. A lot of this takes pretty high-powered either radios or radar, and it saps the batteries. And, you know, the little motor that runs the propeller that keeps it in the air doesn't generate enough electricity to run that much equipment. So you need another source, and usually they have, you know, zinc air batteries or something like that can deliver a lot of energy in over a period of time, and then you bring it back and change out the electrolyte. The Sandia Northrop Grumman team looked at numerous different power systems for large and medium-sized drones before settling on a nuclear solution. I reckon so. I hope that the Iranians haven't figured out how to land this puppy on the tarmac. They might pick up some pointers. Northrop Grumman is known to have patented a drone equipped with a helium-cooled nuclear reactor as long ago as 1986, and has previously worked on nuclear projects with the U.S. Air Force Research Laboratory. Designs for nuclear-powered aircraft go back as far as the 1950s, I told you, with my good friend and associate Stanton Friedman. The research team found that the nuclear drones were able to provide far more surveillance time and intelligence information per mission compared to other technologies. Now, I want you to make sure that you understand that sentence. At first, when we began this article, we were talking about a proposal for a drone on paper. This says that the research team found that the nuclear drones were able to provide far more surveillance time and intelligence information per mission compared to other technologies. That means, that's right, very good. They've already built it. They're already flying it over the sands of Nevada. It reduces considerable costs of support systems, eliminating the need, for example, for forward bases and fuel supplies in remote and possibly hostile areas. It is a well-known fact, observation, report, statistic, that each time we move fuel in a tactical manner, we lose one soldier. Each time we move fuel in a tactical world, we lose one soldier. Anything that they can do to reduce the movement of fuel saves lives. A halt has been called to the work for now due to worries that public opinion will not accept the idea of such a potentially hazardous technology with the inherent dangers of either a crash, in effect turning the drone into a so-called dirty bomb, or of its nuclear propulsion system falling into the hands of terrorists or unfriendly powers, especially if they were just to take control of it through some Chinese chip backdoor, land that puppy safely, take the reactor out, put it into a trash can, and deliver it to downtown Baltimore. So you get the idea. It's not the public worrying about this. It's the reality that we should not be flying nuclear reactors around in the sky with nobody riding it. Okay? Sandia confirmed that the project had been completed. Sandia is often asked to look at a wide range of solutions to the toughest technical challenges. The research on this topic was highly theoretical and very conceptual. The work only resulted in a preliminary feasibility study, and no hardware was ever built or tested. The project has ended. Well, see, now they're saying that no hardware was ever built or tested. But I think that flies in the face of two paragraphs before where it says the research team found that the nuclear drones were able to provide more surveillance time and intelligence information. What are they saying in this article? According to a summary of the research published by the Federation of American Scientists, an independent think tank, computer-based projections were used to test the concepts. Ah, in other words, it was virtual. Based on requirements and direction provided by Northrop Grumman, Sandia provided focus studies to translate stated needs into conceptual designs and processes that could be transferred easily from Sandia to industry, design, and production personnel. I told you they're big into technology transfer. So sensitive is the issue that the summary does not spell out the fact that it is referring to a nuclear-powered drone, referring instead to propulsion and power technologies that went well beyond existing hydrocarbon technologies. However, the project's lead investigator at Sandia, Dr. Stephen Drone, oh, get out of here. Dr. Stephen Drone builds drones. That's too much, guys, too much. You pick some other name. And is well known as a specialist in nuclear propulsion, having co-chaired a session in the 2008 Symposium on Space Nuclear Power and Propulsion held at the University of New Mexico in 2008. Now, I did hear that they were doing a nuclear-powered drone to fly over Mars. Not too many terrorists on Mars, I don't think. So if it crashes out there on Mars, it's only a small act of war against an uninhabited planet. The research summary also stated that the results were to be used in the next generation of unmanned air vehicles for military and intelligence purposes, where they would have provided system performance unparalleled by any existing technologies. No kidding. The MQ-9 Reaper. coming to a neighborhood near you. Our call-in number tonight, 888-429-5471. If you have to leave and go out and do something, spend your income tax return money, you can also listen to the program by calling into the conference line, 760-569-7676, and dialing the passcode number 192-919-pound. Also, I would like you to email me if you're listening live or if you listen to the archive. You know the address, bagnew@x2-radio.com, bagnew@x2-radio.com. I want your opinion on offering video as part of this program. I experimented with it on the Kevin Smith Show last week, and frankly, I was pretty impressed. The technology is pretty simple. You can go to bbsradio.com and you can click on it and watch the video. It's inexpensive, I understand, but the quality is pretty good. So if you want to see yours truly as well as here, I think we can set that up. But I want your opinion before we go through all the work that it takes to get that video content up there. Like I have to, you know, take a shower before the show and stuff like that. All that work. You know what I'm talking about. Anyway, before I go through all that, I would like your opinion. Would you like to see and hear, or are you happy with just listening with the headphones? Also want to, if you just joined us, let you know that Alienated Nation, the new Quest for Liberty, is now in print. It went to the publisher this weekend. It is being reviewed. As soon as I finish reviewing the copy, which I expect is going to be perfect because they're always perfect when they do their work. It will be in print in a few days. It'll be available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and everywhere fine books are sold. But if you buy it from the website, alienatednation.com, you will get the autographed copy. And as I always do with my books, you get the audio version for free. So if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. Now, this is a little different genre. I have long been not a pundit. No. I've been a political student. I have written speeches for presidential candidates. I have been active in certain support groups for senatorial candidates. And although I am not terrifically outspoken in a political way, I felt so compelled by... I actually have had this book in my mind and in notes for about 5 years, and I felt so compelled at this time that it was the right time to write this book. It's called Alienated Nation. If you ever remember the program Alien Nation, you'll know where it's coming from. We are at an impasse with our planet, with our nation. The entire planet sits on the edge, on the very precipice, where we have been as a race many times before, I suspect. And, you know, when the first Constitutional Convention was called, the first arrivals began to write a skeleton, a working procedure, a framework for having the convention, for talking about the issues and amendments that they were going to make to this Constitution as it was ratified. Now, in those days, it took a while for people to travel. They walked, they rode horses, they took wagons, you know, weather. It took weeks for people to get to the convention from all over the country. And as you know, very few natural-born citizens. That's why there's that 35-year rule there. The natural-born citizen rule, it was waived for 35 years because they figured anybody that was alive at the time of the ratification of the Constitution could not be natural born because, well, there was no United States. There was no America. And there was going to be. So anybody born after that time to two American citizens would be eligible to run for president. And there were a lot of things that needed to be discussed. You know, there's only been 27 amendments. The first 10 were with the original Constitution. So it's only been amended 17 times. And a couple of those were were kind of stupid amendments, like banning alcohol and then allowing alcohol. And I mean, that's a waste of two right there. Lots of things that the federal government took power or took seized control of, even though it was not a power expressly given to it by the Constitution. And so amendments had to be drawn up in order to give legislators a framework or at least a backstop. And of course, the Supreme Court, some kind of standard to go by in order to make decisions as to whether or not that legislation was constitutional or not. Obviously, coming to great loggerheads and, you know, Marbury versus Madison. I don't know if you know the details of that. Long story short, Adams was president. Madison was going to take over, did. Several in the 11th hour, they called a whole bunch of justices of the peace, and their inaugurations pushed over into the next presidency. Unfortunately, well, maybe fortunately, John Marshall was then appointed to be Chief Justice. And what he did is he went back and made the entire act unconstitutional. So none of those chief justices or justices of the peace, received their commission. And so Marbury, who was one of the justices of the peace that was supposed to get his commission and didn't, sued, and he lost. So that was the great schism between the Supreme Court being able to make a law that Congress had made unconstitutional. It is the first time that it happened in a grand scale, and it has happened a few times since, and it's about to happen again. However, the Constitution is written so that there are three powers, executive, legislative, and judicial, that are somewhat balanced. They get lopsided a little bit, depends on the charisma of the members of those branches, but by and large, one keeps the other in check, which means one doesn't run away with the show. But in 1932, we had a very strange situation. We had a very strange economic situation after an engineered crash of the stock market, which, of course, was engineered by the very most wealthy and very most privy to information, positioned themselves just right with the right kind of currency. And they ended up on, well, the good end of the stick, and they whipped the hell out of everybody else. The middle class completely evaporated. I mean, you couldn't find someone in the middle class from New York to San Francisco. Gone, evaporated. You had the very wealthy, and you had the impoverished. You worked for 25 cents a day on all the potatoes you could carry home. It was, in a word, a disaster. But it was something we would have recovered from. Arrive on the scene was Superman. No, I'm sorry. It wasn't Superman. It was Roosevelt. Hoover did his best. He was an engineer, tried to streamline government, did something that I guess we've been doing ever since. He let two of the largest bankers in the United States into the committees of Congress. And yeah, they actually attended the committees and were privy to all the information in the committees. And we're talking insider trading, all capital letters. Dawes and Young positioned themselves as mega bankers. They financed all of the war reparations of Germany, which, by the way, were just paid off October of last year. Yeah. When did World War I occur? That's right. Yeah, over, done with, before 1918. 1918, folks. 2011, Germany finally paid their war reparations off. That's how much interest the banks made on that. But as though that wasn't enough, financing some of the war debt, they also financed the reindustrialization of Germany. The Treaty of Versailles was nothing more than the motivation framework for the Second World War. This time, the bankers would make huge amounts of money. Wars R Us was created. The military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about was created, and, that's right, 13 new agencies, departments, bureaus, and administrations were created. Some of them have gone by the wayside. Some of them have expanded and split and grown into other things, and then we have added more. Bush added Homeland Security, and Obama added two more without advice and consent of the Senate, and it has gotten out of control. Now, what we have are agencies, departments, bureaus, and administrations that write regulations, and they write regulations at a plethoric rate, which overcomes the ability of Congress to oversee. In fact, a lot of the regulations are written to keep Congress out of the way. It is illegal for Congress to get involved. Yes, that's right. Absolutely not legal. It's considered outside negotiation. It is verboten. Not allowed. So while the regulations take off, the secretaries, all capital letters again, the secretaries, spelled M-I-N-I-S-T-E-R-S. Secretaries. I mean ministers. Yeah. Just like King George. Just like Saddam Hussein. Just like, yeah, you got it. Same thing. Governmental ministers have almost total discretion over how these regulations are interpreted. They may be written one way, but the secretary, the minister, may have another way. Now, keep in mind that this secretary, minister, is appointed by the executive branch, a la the president. There is no congressional oversight. There is no Senate approval. Not anymore. There is no Supreme Court watching. This is all done through litigation. Litigation and regulation. Litigation and regulation. One word is missing. Representation. That's right. Not there. Taxation without representation from top to bottom. And it is corrupt from top to bottom. The GSA party in Vegas, you know, what happened in Vegas today? Yeah, oh, you get it. The Fifth Amendment. That's right. You'll see the hearings coming up this next week. And believe me, I don't want, if you watch any of these hearings on C-SPAN or whatever, don't eat before. Don't eat, because you're going to get sick. You're going to vomit. It is absolutely repulsive to watch these government officials claim the Fifth Amendment and not, because nobody wrote anything down, I'm sure. Oh, yeah, they got the checkbook. They got the debit cards. Come on, these people went through $146,000 worth of alcohol in 3 days. You can't do that and get away with it. Somebody saw something. Somebody is going to get their cell phone or their Facebook subpoenaed or something. There are pictures out there somewhere. So far, only one person has been asked to resign, and that was Ms. Brown, who was the GSA administrator. There were 300 involved in this thing in Vegas. At the very least, keep in mind, they spent $75,000 just checking Vegas out for the few months before they had the party of all parties. And they were just out doing the other divisions of the GSA's parties. This, my friends, is just the tip of the iceberg. Now, it's not just a bunch of people out there complaining. It's not just a bunch of grievances. States are involved at a very, very high level. Late this last year, as many as 40 states have passed some form of sovereignty act. I don't know if you know the significance of that, but if you are a Civil War history buff, you're going to learn a little bit about it in the book at alienatednations.com. But the states got a little bit sick and tired of the federal government telling them what to do and not paying for it, restricting their trade between themselves and other countries, and taxing them into oblivion with tariffs, going in and going out, blockades against their trade, et cetera, et cetera. And so they filed a list of grievances, the main one of which is taxation without representation. The other one was unfair confiscatory taxes on the South, pumping it into the industries and wealthy communities of the North. The South got tired of it, and they finally kicked him out of Sumter. So once the Union had been kicked out of Sumter, which is kind of an interesting story, you need to read about it in the book. I'm sure there are details you never learned in school. Pretty fascinating stuff how this whole battle went down. I mean, talk about Southern gentlemen. Really unbelievable warfare back then. But the good news is not one single person got killed. It was kind of neat. 32 hours of bombardment and, you know, nobody got a scratch on them. It was pretty nice. It's the way war should be. Just a whole lot of noise and fireworks and money and everybody walks away. I think it'd be great. In any case, once the Union had been kicked out of the South, and a new nation had been formed with its own currency and its own president and its own government and its own laws and its own ability to trade with Europe without federal oversight, the lack of leadership in the White House was not able to diplomatically pull it back together. And so he had only one choice, and that's to rape, pillage, and burn. You know, typical federal tactics. And it works every time, whether you're in Waco, Texas, or whether you're in Charleston, South Carolina, or Atlanta. So a lot of this is in the book, and what we now have are 40 states that have signed some form of sovereignty act, and some of the language is quite bold. We put Utah's and we put Tennessee's resolutions in there in the book so you can read them for yourself. Otherwise, you'd have to go out and do all this research for yourself, and you wouldn't get my great opinion. So I put it in there so that you can be informed. The reason that this number is important, this 40 number is important, is because according to the Constitution, it takes two-thirds of the states to ratify an amendment. And the only way that can be done is at a constitutional convention. So the book is actually a call for convention. Not many people understand that term, so we put the new quest for liberty. Didn't want to put anything about revolution or civil war on the front of it and be that inflammatory. But after the second page of the book, you'll get the idea. AlienatedNation.com, pick it up. Some fascinating reading. And yes, I am. I'm sending a copy to O'Reilly and Hannity and all those guys too, because they're all the time pushing killing Lincoln. And this is kind of the other side of the border, the other side of the story, the recent unpleasantness up until now. And some of this stuff is so up to date, so modern. Literally within hours of publishing the book, major breaking news that's in the book. It's just really, really powerful stuff. 190 pages that will just get you rocking and get you ready to do something between now and November. And this news story kind of ties into it because we are one nation under surveillance. One nation under surveillance. It's true. Go out driving tomorrow. You probably won't be able to see it. You won't be able to see it at night, but if you go out driving tomorrow, you'll see it. Any intersection. Look up. Not that far up, just up, you know, like toward the top of your windshield. You'll see them. Cameras. Cameras on poles, cameras on arms, cameras on cameras, cameras with balls, cameras with tubes, cameras with big wireless transmitters that all go to a central station. What in the world are they watching? Well, the NSA, National Security Administration, is not far from knowing all about us. Not long before my good friend Dick Armey, conservative Republican constitutionalist, retired as House Majority Leader, back in 1996, Dick Armey and Graham and Van Hillary, not Hillary Clinton, but Congressman Van Hillary from Tennessee, came to our town, Morristown, Tennessee. We had dinner and we talked about strategy and we talked about, you know, the politics, local politics, and what we were doing and what we could do to support them. Dick Armey's a great guy. Anyway, he gave a speech expressing his worry about the government's increasing blanket surveillance over we the people. He practically begged President George W. Bush to use these tools we have given you to make us safe in such a manner that'll preserve our freedom. Bush's response, alas, was to listen more and more to Vice Presidential candidate Dick Cheney, or Vice President Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney's a smart guy, but he comes from the CIA, like Bush's dad, and always has, I'm not going to say nefarious, but he always has suspicion in his actions. Whatever he puts in place, he wants to make sure that the bad guys don't get a leg up. And the bad guys are italicized in this statement of mine because we don't really know who they are. Now, we thought for a while we knew what accent they had, and we knew what they dressed like, and we knew what country they came from, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, governments are kind of funny because they fabricate enemies. They can be political. Watergate is nothing compared to what they're doing now. Nothing. Just look at the scandal of the Secret Service tonight on the news. You remember a couple of weeks ago we were talking about the GSA and how they spent $822,000 in Vegas, and I'm telling you, that's just the tip of the iceberg. That's the only what showed up in the checkbook. There was a slush fund that big or more. Anyway, in order to shift the light away from any liability of the current administration, they have to point the light at something. And so they pointed at a more establishment organization, which would be the Secret Service. And so that's what you see in the news. This whole thing, 11 Secret Service members suspended and on and on and on. This is just smoke and mirrors, just to kind of keep you fogged over so that you don't pay attention about what's going on up there at the Pentagon. So now, for the first time in history, according to the Government Accountability Project's Jesselyn Raddick, Attorney General Eric Holder has officially and publicly declared new guidelines that permit the federal counterterrorism investigators to collect, search, and store data about Americans who are not suspected of terrorism or anything else. And webcast radio hosts, too, I'll bet. I'll bet. If they knew where I was, wow. See, I'm in an undisclosed location east of the Appalachians. Could be anywhere. I could be anywhere. I could be in Mississippi. I could be in Texas. I could be in Washington, D.C. According to the Justice Department, law enforcement and other national security agencies can copy entire databases and sift through the data for suspicious patterns to stop potential terrorist threats. Dun, dun, dun. Where in the Constitution do suspicious patterns, otherwise defined as outside and outside the jurisdiction of our courts, allow the government to put large and growing numbers of us into databases for future tracking? It's true. They could do that. I remember when you suddenly started buying Florida orange juice. We know that people that buy Florida orange juice and drive Volvos and wear New Balance tennis shoes fit into a pattern of potential juice drinkers, which is indicative of your propensity to listen to conservative talk show hosts. Yeah, that's a suspicious pattern, if I ever heard one. Indeed, Raddick writes, this gossamer of information is being stored on Americans who are not even thinking about committing a crime. How do they know that they're not even thinking about committing a crime? How do you know? Is it because they buy vanilla ice cream? Is it because they drive a Volkswagen? How do they know that Americans who are not even thinking about committing a crime? What if we're all thinking about committing a crime? Yeah. Jeez, Mr. Raddick. As of this writing, Mitt Romney appears very likely to be the Republicans' choice to thwart President Barack Obama's desire for a second term. All those in favor? Oh, I don't see too many hands out there. Okay, well, I'm not telling you how to vote. I'm just telling you to vote. Have you heard any objection from him on this purge of privacy? You know, honestly, I don't think you're going to yet. You know, we have some time to go. That speech I heard yesterday was quite powerful that Mitt Romney gave. I mean, he, you know, put a lot of syncopation behind his words when he was talking about the potential of President Barack Obama choosing new Supreme Court justices in the next 4 years. That is a change that cannot be undone with the next president so easily. That is a change that shifts the power in the judicial branch for up to 30 years, maybe more. It's hard to undo that damage, you know. You don't just go impeach chief or justices of the Supreme Court. It's not so easy to do, because if they don't do anything, there's not much to impeach. So it's just a matter of opinion. Yeah, just a matter of opinion. So there is time, I think, for this to gel. So don't count everybody out just yet. And which government agency will lead in this final death sentence for the Fourth Amendment? Emerging from its customary deep secrecy is our nation's, and probably the world's, most immense spy center, the National Security Agency, responsible for more satellites in space than everybody put together. This particular writer became aware of the NSA when Senator Frank Church, Democrat from Idaho, was in charge of a Senate committee on intelligence activities in 1975, back when I was in college. Church was fearfully startled when he came upon the agency, until then operating unknown to the great majority of Americans. That's right, we never heard anything about the NSA way back when, even in 75. Nobody really knew who the NSA was. Now we know about it because it's been the subject of a lot of movies, you know, Eagle Eye and all of that, on and on and on, all the One Nation Under Surveillance. By the way, Alex, my good friend up there in Missouri, I trust that you survived all of the twisters that were up there. We had some really, really strange weather. It's the first time the NOAA has offered sent out a warning of deadly weather 24 hours in advance. Yeah, they could tell from space this was going to be a barn buster. So I trust Alex, you made it okay. But anyway, he has his tongue firmly in cheek and says that Mitt Romney is an eye poker. I like it. That's what we need. Pie fights and eye poking in the White House. I think it would be cool. Wait a minute. He writes me back. He says, a lot of promises, no answers. Well, come on. Isn't that normal for politicians? I mean, I started getting involved in it when Nixon ran for his first term. Promises. And I remember my brother saying, yeah, but how's he going to pay for it all? Well, I didn't think about stuff like that. I mean, you know, I was a kid, so now we really think about it. How are we going to pay for this kind of health care plan or that kind of health care plan? By the way, I have an idea about that. I'll run it by you sometime. Just you and me. I think that the Republican Party does the strangest method of political activity. I was going to say activism, but that's not exactly right. I was talking to Sean Hannity one day, and I told him that he is what is wrong with the Republican Party, which really got his eyebrows up, and And he came right back at me and said, how am I the problem with the Republican Party? And I said, because you guys up there always pick the tallest guy with the perfect hair and all the money. And it's, you take the guy who it's his turn to run. You know, Romney ran in 2008. He was, you know, two left feet, two left hands, and couldn't seem to get anything right. Made me nervous to watch him, and I'm probably not the only one. And now here we are in 2012, and it's his turn because he ran and he lost and he hung in there and he made more money, and now he's going to run again. So you're not taking the guy who really could do something. I mean, has there ever been a brighter or a more brilliant a politician than Newt Gingrich? Do I like him? No, not particularly. I think morally, you know, getting guidance this late in life is not the kind of guidance that sticks with you when you're alone at the top. I can tell you from experience, not just mine, but others, that it is lonely at the top. And a lot of times, a lot of people are there giving you advice. But at the end of the day, it's your decision. And it's not the decision of a manager. It's the decision of a leader. There's a big difference. You know, because managers do the right thing or do things right and leaders do the right thing. That's a big difference when all of your advisors are telling you one thing and your moral compass, the thing that makes you the president, the thing that makes you put your pants on a little bit differently than everybody else says something else. It says, I'm not going to say I don't care what you say. I do, and I respect it. But I've taken that into consideration. And I've been to the future and looked back at this point, and I can tell you this is the right decision. And a leader makes right decisions because they have the capability of doing that. I don't know if Mitt Romney is that guy. I don't know if Newt Gingrich is that guy. I don't know if a guy that's been saying the same thing for 25 years and now we're warming up to the idea of liberty and all of that, I don't know if that's the right guy. The point I was trying to make to Sean is that this is the way the Republican Party works. We don't let new ideas come in. We don't let new people with a moral compass and fresh energy come in. And that's why the Democrats can find anybody, even with a name like Barack, on the streets of Chicago. Totally obscure, brand new freshman senator that doesn't even know his way to all the men's rooms in Washington. And we can make him president. Just like that. We can put that slick freshness against a polished, seasoned, dynastic politician like John McCain and wax the floor with him. That's what I'm talking about. That's what I was trying to explain to Sean. You guys have it all wrong. You need to find the guy or woman with the energy and the moral compass and the leadership to make right decisions. And that's what you need to put in play. We, the Republican Party, the Libertarian Party, cannot figure that out. And I don't think they have with Mitt Romney either. Let's take a quick break. Letters from the Sky, Civil Twilight. We'll be right back after this with more X Squared Radio.
were not made for this. I was made to taste your kiss. We were made to never fall away. Never fall away.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. So glad that you could be here with us. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. And without you, we would not be here. So so glad to have you here. There's no question about it that you make it worth coming. We're in our seventh year now here at X Squared Radio. We have become one of the top shows, often the number one program on the BBS Radio Network, and the BBS Radio Network is the largest webcast radio network in the United States, possibly in the world. And it's because of the love and passion of the owners of the program. Those of you that know them, love them, and you can call us tonight, 888-888-429-5471, 888-429-5471, and be part of the program tonight. And I encourage you to do that. You know, I'm as easy going as I can be, and I want to talk about whatever you want to talk about. And we are heading into many things that are going to change the world this year. We have the advent of 2012. We also have the elections of 2012, and maybe they're tied together. Maybe this is a manifestation of the consciousness of the people of the world, how it happens, how it comes together. we were talking about the NSA in the last hour. By the way, I just want to let you know, Alex writes, when Santorum, Romney, and Gingrich were all in the race, we called them the Three Stooges because they were all always poking each other's eyes out. Whoop, 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 whoop. Why, how would you like a pop? What flavor? Five delicious flavors. And taking pot shots at Barack at the debates instead of talking principle and answering questions like Ron Paul always did. You're absolutely right, Alex. Absolutely right. And I don't know why it is that our establishment presidential election system has just not allowed Ron Paul to be a candidate. He gets the delegates. His message is consistent. It's positive. It keeps the president, the federal powers within the Constitution. And anyone else in the business goes outside of that. But if there was anyone that was running for president that understood the power of the president, understood what to do with it, what diplomacy and what strategy was, it was Newt Gingrich. I'm not saying that the smartest guy in the room should be the president. Often that is not the case. It is the guy who can hold his own when the energy gets tough. When everyone else has left the room because what is happening in that room is so frightening, so challenging, that it makes the ordinary man sweat spinal fluid. But the president can stand there with his eyes steady, no tears, a steady hand, a steady mind, with leadership and inspiration, and do the right thing. I can tell you, and I think you will agree with me, that the age when we can have a president who cannot act unless he is looking at a teleprompter are over. We must have a man or men. Maybe the job's too big for one president. Maybe we need to do like what I said would happen in my book, Remembering the Future. Maybe we need to have a presidential council. Maybe the executive branch needs to be expanded so there's not one president and a vice president. Maybe there's one president and two vice presidents, and each vice president has a jurisdiction, domestic policy, foreign policy, and the president is the tiebreaker. Maybe we need to have something where it's more than one man thinking and doing and trying to handle the largest corporation in the history of the world. Well, I guess you could say the British Empire was larger than that, but, you know, the sun never set on the British Empire. But for sure, with the most powerful army and the most powerful banks and the most powerful earning power in the world that the world has ever known, it takes somebody who has leadership to be able to make that go. And when you have the ability, not necessarily to stimulate the economy, but when you have the ability to throw a wet blanket on the economy, you have the ability to stop the flow of money. You know, this merry-go-round has to keep moving. I've always maintained, ever since I had my first business synapse fire, money has to keep moving. The money ever stops moving, then the entire economy comes apart because it's one big set of dominoes. It is going to come apart. And when it does, the weaker parts of it are going to shatter. They're going to break. They're not going to be able to handle the stress. And if they can't handle the stress, then the axles begin to break and the wheel falls apart. And that's where we're at. We have not leadership in place. We have an organization in place. I'm going to call it an agency government. I talk about it a lot in the book, Alienated Nation, the new quest for liberty. And the agency government has now taken over. They're running everything. So when the NSA came to power, or at least came to the realization, the public came to the realization that it existed, the technology was in its infancy compared to its ever-increasing range and depth that we have today. Today, there's no place to hide. There's no way to fight back because the most careful effort to combine resistance to the government, no matter how privately it is done, is within the reach of government to know. You can't move. You can't meet at a pizza parlor without them knowing about it. You can't drive out in the middle of the desert and slip yourself into a cone of silence and have a meeting. You think you can, but they're going to know. Because somewhere along the way, you tweeted or you had a phone conversation or you sent a courier or something to let them know what you were planning. 30 years after Church's principled stand, the Washington Post reported that the NSA had already been enlisting other intelligence agencies to assist its surveillance of people inside the country suspected of having terrorist connections. Does this sound at all, you know, like J. Edgar Hoover, who thought there were communists in and out of our government who had dirt on almost everyone in politics and law enforcement? Here we are today with Obama urgently working to extend his power as commander-in-chief over all of us not in uniform. The Rutherford Institute's John Whitehead, the Frank Church of our time, reports, in the small town of Bluffdale, Utah, not far from bustling Salt Lake City, the federal government is quietly erecting what will be the crown jewel of its surveillance empire. It's true. You know, 73% of the state of Utah is owned by the federal government. Rising up out of the desert landscape, the Utah Data Center. Yep, it's got an acronym, UDC. A $2 billion behemoth designed to house a network of computers, satellites, and phone lines that stretches across the world, is intended to serve as, I know, you're holding your breath, it's okay, the central hub of the National Security Agency's vast spying infrastructure. Once complete, and the UDC is expected to be fully operational by September of 2013, a little more than a year from now, the last link in the chain of the electronic concentration camp that surrounds us will be complete. And privacy as we have known it will be extinct. We will be one nation under surveillance. Don't give up that fast, though, Earth Explorers. Members of Congress should be sharply awakened by their constituents and reminded what country they are in. They should act for privacy if they want to remain in office. As for the next president, unless, of course, he's Ron Paul, I don't think that's a chance. He will just continue to wave the flag and sing the Star-Spangled Banner. Bombs bursting in air. So, feel any safer? Didn't think so. But you can feel safe while you're here at X Squared Radio because we will keep you informed. And I know what you're saying, but I'm not doing anything wrong. So why should I have anything to fear? Well, it's not about doing anything wrong. It's about thinking about doing something wrong. You remember the vanilla ice cream, the orange juice, the New Balance tennis shoes, the Volvo, electric car, health food, cigarettes. Come on, there are patterns here. didn't you go to the Bahamas last summer on a cruise? Well, yes, I did. Aha, I thought so. All right, enough of that stuff. We don't do conspiracy theories on this program, but it's not a theory. It's an observation, which makes it a fact. All right, some of the great observers that we have right now, Stephen Hawking, obviously one of the greatest physicists of all time, a wonderful theoretical physicist and thinker. A local company has released a stunning finding after performing some unique tests on the human brain, including that of famed physicist Dr. Stephen Hawking. You know, he has to communicate using his, you know, face muscles and things like that because he's paralyzed from Lou Gehrig's disease. But his face muscles are slowly failing. But he soon may not need them, thanks to technology by La Jolla-based NeuroVigil. Everybody to La Jolla? No? Show of hands? Two? Okay. It's cool. La Jolla is in Southern California. It's kind of an exclusive neighborhood north of San Diego, just a little bit. On the beach, you know, kind of a cliffside village of people. Back in the 70s, we used to go there, throw frisbee, jump off a rock formation called the clam, which you just kind of wait for the sea to come in and swell it full and then jump into it. Yeah, it's fun. We used to dive for abalone and stuff off of there, but nice community. Houses are all packed in as close as you can get them, and they don't have much, you know, earthquake activity and stuff down there, and it's way away from L.A., a couple of hours, so it's just one of those places that the weather's nice all the time. Anyway, great universities down there, Scripps and other schools. So Chairman Philip Lowe of NeuroVigil, he has this system called iBrain. He says he's very enthusiastic about it. Lowe created the iBrain, the world's first mobile brain scanner. Lowe, who first met Hawking at a conference, says he believes it can read Hawking's thoughts. Very interesting. The iBrain fits right over the head and features three electrodes that connect very easily. This past summer, Lowe flew to Cambridge, England, and Hawking agreed to wear the device. He was asked to think very hard about doing various tasks while his brain waves were tracked. Using a special algorithm to convert the wave patterns, Lowe learned each of those thoughts, produced its own distinctive brainwave patterns, which can be mapped out. Eventually, Lowe believes a computer could read the pattern and speak Hawking's thoughts. Could be dangerous. Because a lot of times we think things we don't want to say. You know, come on. We think a lot of things we don't want to say. We think in pictures. We think in colors and relationships and, you know, abstract metaphorical interactions of thoughts and things that don't normally belong together. How do you put that into words? We don't think in words. We'd like to find a way to bypass his body, pretty much hack his brain, said Lowe. That ability to decipher each person's brainwave patterns could have major implications. Pharmaceutical companies can now fine-tune the drugs for the individuals. This is the first step to personalized medicine, Lowe said. Mr. Lowe, you better be careful there. iBrain, because, you know, we have another government agency, it's called the FDA, and they're not too happy about people getting into the pharmaceutical business, a la vitamin C, that evil, wicked vitamin that has that terrible rumor that if you take it, you'll be healthy. What rubbish. Everyone knows that you need Zoloft. Ask your doctor today. Eyebrain is also being looked at as a possible way to monitor and diagnose a number of conditions, from sleep disorders, depression, neurological disorders, autism, post-traumatic stress disorder. It's exciting for us because it allows us to have a window into the brain. We're building technology that will allow humanity to have access to the human brain for the first time. No, not really true. You know, we've had lie detectors and we've had electroencephalograms for a long, long time, and we can map brain waves. Although we don't do it with a pen on paper anymore, now we kind of do it as a wave shape. And it's a little like exploring for oil, Mr. Lowe. You just look for patterns that fit, and then you write algorithms. An algorithm is a mathematical function that can take multiple inputs. It's not like a simple volume control. It's three controls into one dynamic output. If any of you have ever been to a military funeral in which Taps was played, this brings out a new meaning of it. I have myself, not my own funeral, of course, but another funeral. And I've also heard Taps played by various musicians where the lone melancholy horn, trumpet, bugle really brings a tear to the eye. You can see how it can be used to move one to a very sad state. Well, here is something every American should know. And until I read this, I didn't know, but I checked it out. And it's true. And I want you to hear this. You probably haven't heard it before. But this is where the song came from. We in the United States have all heard the haunting song Taps. It's a song that gives us the lump in our throats and usually tears in our eyes, especially if we have lost someone, especially if the person that's playing it on the trumpet really, you know, delivers the emotion of it. But you probably don't know the story behind the song, and I didn't. So I was given this by a friend and wanted to share it with you. This is the humble beginning of the song Taps. Reportedly, it all began in 1862 during the Civil War, the war between the states, or as we say it in the South, the recent unpleasantness, when Union Army Captain Robert Ely was with his men near Harrison's Landing in Virginia. The Confederate Army was on the other side of the narrow strip of land. During the night, Captain Ely heard the moans of a soldier who lay severely wounded on the field. Not knowing if it was a Union or a Confederate soldier, the captain decided to risk his life and bring the stricken man back for medical attention. Crawling on his stomach through the gunfire, the captain reached the stricken soldier and began pulling him toward his encampment. When the captain finally reached his own lines, he discovered it was actually a Confederate soldier, but the soldier was dead. The captain lit a lantern and suddenly caught his breath and went numb with shock. In the dim light of the lantern, he saw the face of the soldier. It was his own son. The boy had been studying music in the South when the war broke out. Without telling his father, the boy enlisted in the Confederate Army. The following morning, heartbroken, the father asked permission of his superiors to give his son a full military burial, despite his enemy status. His request was only partially granted. The captain had asked if he could have a group of Army band members play a funeral dirge for his son at the funeral, and the request was turned down since the soldier was a Confederate. But out of respect for the father, they did say they could give him only one musician. The captain chose a bugler. He asked the bugler to play a series of musical notes he had found on a piece of paper in the pocket of the dead youth's uniform. The wish was granted. The haunting melody, we now know as Taps, used at military funerals, was born. The words are, day is gone, gone the sun. From the lakes, from the hills, from the sky, all is well. Safely rest. God is nigh. Fading light dims the sight, and a star gems the sky, gleaming bright from afar. Drawing nigh falls the night. Thanks and praise for our days. Neath the sun, neath the stars, neath the sky as we go, this we know, God is nigh. That's the origin of Taps. Now, as though you didn't think things could get any weirder, you ever go to a restaurant or a place of business where eventually you have to use the men's room or the ladies' room? And you get in the ladies' room and there, or the men's room, and there's a blinking fluorescent light in the ceiling. You know, it's like, oh yeah, blinking light in the ceiling. Zombies are going to show up any moment. Well, Putin, you know, in Russia, he has a new weapon. Yeah, it's called a zombie gun. Mm-hmm. Mind-bending psychotronic guns that can effectively turn people into zombies have been given the go-ahead by Russian President Vladimir Putin. Yeah, they will be used in the American presidential election. I'm kidding. That part I'm putting in there. The futuristic weapons, which will attack the nervous system of their victims, are being developed by the country's scientists. They could be used against Russia's enemies and perhaps its own dissidents by the end of the decade. Guys, it's 2012. So within 8 years, we're talking about this weapon being a reality. Sources in Moscow say Mr. Putin has described the guns, which use electromagnetic radiation like that found in a microwave ovens, we know it as HARP, as entirely new instruments for achieving political and strategic goals. And that's a quote. Mr. Putin added such high-tech weapons systems will be comparable in effect to nuclear weapons, but will be more acceptable in terms of political and military ideology because they are non-lethal. My good friend Dr. Nick Begich from Alaska, co-contributor to Holes in Heaven, which was one of the most telling and chilling documentaries ever done on HARP. I built a scale model of the weather modification section of HARP for Jesse Ventura for his show called Conspiracy Theories on True TV. You can watch it on that channel, and you can also watch it on History Channel. And we are in the process of doing a new documentary. That's absolutely true. Paula Randall Jones is getting ready to produce another video. She's the original producer of Holes in Heaven. She's getting ready to produce a new one with the new evidence that's out. And let me tell you, this is real. It's as real as it gets. Dr. Nick Begich has in his books Earth Rising and Earth Rising 2 very accurately described the psychotronic function of HARP. Is one of the things that Dr. Bernard Eastland, who is the guy that invented HARP for the Navy, was under a gag order for a number of years, and then the gag order finally expired, and he and I and Dr. Nick Begich and Pat Flanagan and others under the expert direction of Wendy Robbins, an award-winning film director, put together this documentary way back in 1997, which is still a top seller at all the conventions. And now there's a new one coming out. But these functions of HAARP are real. These frequencies have been experimentally discovered and can be focused and put into maybe not a handheld unit, but maybe a truck-based unit or a shoulder-based unit with a suitcase that goes with it. And they can not only put you in the chair and turn you into a zombie, but they can turn you into a zombie from a distance or maybe even from space. Some of listeners are saying, well, yeah, I guess it's better than being nuked. It is, in the sense that you're not vaporized, your eyes don't fall from the sockets, and your skin melt from your face before your body hits the ground. In that sense, it's a better thing. In the sense that somebody has to feed you for the rest of your life, maybe not. So plans to introduce the super weapons were announced quietly last week by Russian Defense Minister Anatoly Serdyukov, fulfilling a little-noticed election campaign pledge by President-elect Putin. I have the guy's picture, so I might put it on the website. So if you see him somewhere, forget about the blinking light in the men's room. The zombies are coming. Plans to introduce the super weapons were announced. The development of weaponry based on new physics principles, direct energy weapons, geophysical weapons, wave energy weapons, genetic weapons, psychotronic weapons, and so on as part of the state arms procurement program for 2011 through 2020. Sounds encouraging, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. That's going to be right on the front of the GSA schedule for the National Security Administration. Specific proposals on developing the weapons are due to be drawn up before December by a new Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Now, I just had a brainstorm, just a brainstorm. Forget about the drone killing drones. Let's get some of the nuclear powered drones, arm them up with these new zombie guns, and let's send those out against the terrorists. Aha. Forget about blowing them up in a Volkswagen. Just turn them into a zombie. I like it. I want to be the first one with the camera to watch that happen. Research into electromagnetic weapons has been secretly carried out in the U.S. and Russia since the 50s. But wait a minute. I thought it was a secret. But now it appears Mr. Putin has stolen a march on the Americans. Precise details of the Russian gun have not been revealed. However, previous research has shown that low-frequency waves or beams can affect brain cells, alter psychological states, and make it possible to transmit suggestions and commands directly into someone's thought processes. What if we just aimed it at each other's presidents? Yeah. High doses of microwaves can damage the functioning of internal organs, control behavior, or even drive victims to suicide. Anatoly Tsiganok, head of the Military Forecasting Center in Moscow, said this is a highly serious weapon. You know what, Mr. Anatoly, that sounds highly serious. When it was used for dispensing a crowd, when it was used for dispersing a crowd and it was focused on a man, his body temperature went up immediately as if he was thrown into a hot frying pan. Still, we know very little about this weapon, and even special forces guys can hardly cope with it. The long-term effects are not known, but 2 years ago, a former major, I can tell you where this one's going, in the Russian Foreign Intelligence Agency, the GRU, died in Scotland after making claims about such a weapon program to MI6. Sergei Sirk, 43, claimed he was a victim of weapons which he said were many times more powerful than in the Matrix films. Dun, dun, dun. Mr. Sirk died after falling from a Glasgow tower block with his wife and stepson in March 2010. While his death was assumed to be a suicide, his family fear there was foul play. Last night, the Ministry of Defense declined to comment. The question is, will zombies jump off a bridge? Yeah, I don't think that the idea is to cook them on the inside or the outside. I think the idea is to get the thought waves into their mind and make them either do things that you want them to do or not do the things that they had originally planned to do in the first place. In other words, if you have a crowd of people that are charging toward the gate, you turn the weapon on them and suddenly they have an urge that's overpowering for chocolate ice cream. And off they go. Think of the advertising ramifications of such a thing. Forget about subliminal advertising. My goodness. All you need to do is open a taco stand, make them have the urge for ground beef and cheese, and you'll be an instant millionaire. Man. Or, well, I guess you could have political aspirations as well, but who needs it? All the votes are being counted in Europe anyway. Doesn't matter who votes. It's the counting of the votes. Yeah, we could find something interesting to do with that. Okay. Wow, one of my listeners said, I can tell you the long-term effect of drying a dog in the microwave. Okay. Well, we're not going to go into that one too much. All right. Cyber bills legislate for mass surveillance. We already know about this. In the New York Times editorial, former governmental cybersecurity czar. Yeah, we have a czar. Hang on a moment. Before I read this, I need to have some grapefruit juice. Hold on just one second. Pardon the swallowing. Czar is not spelled Z-A-R, except in the South. The real spelling of czar is C-Z-A-R, and it ain't from around here. It is... when they used to have a wall up between Berlin and the other side of Berlin, that's when they had czars, okay? Former government cybersecurity czar, Richard A. Clarkesky, it's not Clarkesky, it's Clark, has called for the creation of customs checks on all data leaving and entering U.S. cyberspace. What? You know, I have partners in India. What does that mean? Customs checks on all data leaving and entering U.S. cyberspace. Hello? Clark makes the call in relation to Chinese hackers stealing information and intellectual property from U.S. firms. Dude, Dick, Richard, listen. You don't need customs. What you need are American-made chips, okay? You have Chinese chips in all the government circuitry. It can be hacked. It's called firmware. It gives the Chinese a free open door to come in through the back and take whatever they want. You don't need customs between U.S. cyberspace and other cyberspace. You need American chip makers. He goes on to say, if given the proper authorization, I'll bet, Mr. Czar, Dick, if given the proper authorization, the United States government could stop files in the process of being stolen from getting to the Chinese hackers, Clark writes. If government agencies were authorized to create a major program to grab stolen data. Dick, how do you know it's stolen? It's secret. They don't do it in front of your eyes. They do it behind your back. grab stolen data leaving the country, they could drastically reduce today's wholesale theft of American corporate secrets. This guy doesn't get it at all. No wonder he's a czar. While Clark may be coming at this subject well-intentioned, the fact that government has a long history of attempting to crack down on internet freedom and control the web will mean his words are a cause of concern for many. Under customs authority, you know, customs, U.S. Customs and Border Security, it's full of lawyers, people, not technical people, okay? They don't get it. They just write laws, regulations, and they do enforcement actions, you know, like the Department of Justice. Okay, not like the Department of Justice, like the EPA, okay? They do enforcement actions. The Department of Justice doesn't enforce anything. Under customs authority, the Department of Homeland Security could inspect what enters and exits the United States in cyberspace, Clark continues. Dick, you're so brilliant. I can't go on. I'm going to the next article. I can't read this stuff. What the heck is this guy talking about? Anybody have any comments on that? 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. Seriously? Are we really seriously? This is in print. Actual czar Richard Clark, Dick Clark, said this. Wow. I would think that the guy needs to be on American Bandstand, not in government. That just blows my mind. Like, dude, we could catch all this data as it's being stolen, and we could really end, you know, this whole Chinese thing. Get out of town. What the heck's going on here? Next story, please. Well, on to the scientific things. Hold on a second. The indomitable Alexander. No, he gets it all right. He wouldn't make much money or many jobs if he did it your way. Yeah, I know, but, you know, like, we don't need any more government jobs. That's the thing. The whole wonderful thing about the internet is that it's a free and open, unlike Rick Santorum would say, it is a free and open, unfettered, uncensored media where nobody smarter than anybody else can say, hey, wait a minute, you can't do that on the internet. What? You can do anything on the internet, except when you don't get any hits. I mean, if nobody's going to look at it, you know, what's the point? And don't forget, lest ye forget, over half the internet isn't even accessible by you. That's right. The only way you can find stuff on Google is if you can find it on Google. The rest of the internet is all address specific. It's all encrypted. It always was. The internet started as a military network. We used to call it the Watts line. It allowed Air Force bases to exchange data, parts, you know, lists, stuff. It was all green screen, you know, tech stuff and drawings and things like that back then. But that was the basics of the internet. Guys, that was in 1973. That was the internet that connected all these locations together. That internet is still there. Over half the data that moves on the internet isn't accessible by you, the public, unless you absolutely know the address. It's not listed. You can't find it with a browser or a search engine. It's unsearchable for a reason. So when we're talking about data like this, we're not talking about data that you can search up. You've got to be able to get into that database. That's why I'm saying the way in is through the Chinese chips that are in the circuits. The Chinese chips infiltrate everything. They're even in our drones, all of our military hardware, everything. The Chinese have the microchips in everything. And in the firmware of those chips is a back door. The Chinese walk right in and take anything they want. There's no way to stop it. Except to, of course, change out all the chips to an American chip maker. You remember, we used to make all the microchips in this country. Now we make less than 2% of them. Yeah, 2%. Go figure. So let's talk about some science, biology. The first human egg cells that have been grown entirely in the laboratory from stem cells could be fertilized later this year in a development that will revolutionize fertility treatment and might even lead to a reversal of the menopause in older women. Scientists are about to request a license from the UK fertility watchdog to fertilize the eggs as part of a series of tests to generate an unlimited supply of human eggs, a breakthrough that could help infertile women to have babies as well as make women as fertile in later life as men. Producing human eggs from stem cells would also open up the possibility of replenishing the ovaries of older women so that they do not suffer the age-related health problems associated with the menopause, from osteoporosis to heart disease. In other words, the ovaries become regenerated again using these stem cells. Some scientists are even suggesting the possibility of producing an elixir of youth for women, where the menopause is eradicated and older women will retain the health they enjoyed when younger. Oh yeah, like that's really going to sell. Are you kidding? You wouldn't be able to write the first check. It would be so large. Researchers at Edinburgh University are working with a team from Harvard Medical School in Boston to be the first in the world to produce mature human eggs from stem cells isolated from human ovarian tissue. We call this immaculate conception. Until now, it has only been possible to isolate a relatively small number of mature human egg cells directly from the ovaries of women who have been stimulated with hormones. But you know, the babies born under these conditions often have birth defects, for lack of a better word. They're mongoloid or, you know, have heart problems or extra encephalitis, you know, things where the brain is outside the skull, all kinds of health problems. This technical limitation has led to an acute shortage of human eggs or oocysts. I'm sorry, for IVF treatment as well as in vitro fertilization, for those of you not in the medical community. The scientists want to fertilize the laboratory-grown egg cells with the human sperm to prove that they are viable. Any resulting embryos will be studied for up to 14 days, the legal limit, to see if they are normal. They can't be kept longer than that because if they are allowed to do that, they will start farming fetal stem cells from the embryos. That's why there's the 14-day limit. Once they hit 14 days, the zygote reaches a point where they are basically breeding stem cells. So it's so valuable that it's illegal, because we would in effect be farming embryos to keep people that already breathe air alive. These early embryos will not be transplanted into a woman's womb because they will be deemed experimental material, but will either be frozen or allowed to perish. Evelyn Telfer, a reproductive biologist at Edinburgh University, has already informally approached the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority, yes, the HFEA, with a view to submitting a formal license application within the next few weeks. She says, "We hope to apply for a research license to do the fertilization of the in vitro growth oocytes within the IVF unit at the Edinburgh Royal Infirmary," Dr. Telfer said. "Could the fertilization take place this year?" "Yes, absolutely," she said. Professor Richard Anderson of the MRC, Center for Reproductive Health, who will be in charge of the clinical aspects of the work, said the aim will be to demonstrate that the eggs that we've generated in vitro are competent. In vitro means in a test tube, are competent to form embryos, and that the best test that an egg is an egg. Generating an unlimited supply of human eggs and the prospect of reversing the menopause was made possible by a series of breakthroughs led by Professor Jonathan Tilley of Harvard. In 2004, he astounded the world of reproductive biology by suggesting that there were active stem cells in the ovaries of mice that seemed capable of replenishing eggs throughout life. For half a century, a dogma of reproductive biology was that women are born with their full complement of egg cells, which they gradually lose through life until they run out when they reach the menopause. This old age belief that females are given a fixed bank of eggs at birth is incorrect, Professor Tilley said. Another fact thrown onto the heap of fables. How about that? In fact, ovaries in adulthood are probably more closely matched to tests in adulthood in their capacity to make new germ cells, which are the special cells that give rise to sperm and eggs. Over the past 50 years, all of the basic science, all the clinical work, and all the clinical outcome was predicated on one simple belief, and that is that the oocyte pool, the early egg cell pool in the ovaries, was a fixed entity. And once those eggs were used up, they cannot be renewed, replenished, or replaced. Last month, Professor Tilley published pioneering research showing that these stem cells exist in human ovaries, and that they could be stimulated in the laboratory to grow into mature egg cells. That is unbelievable. Unbelievable biological breakthrough here. And now you see how Zechariah's wife, Elizabeth, gave birth to John the Baptist after her age. How about that? Stimulated ovaries in the laboratory to grow into immature egg cells. He is collaborating with Dr. Telfer, who was once skeptical of his research, because in Edinburgh she has pioneered a technique for growing immature egg cells to the fully ripened stage when they can be fertilized. It has been fun to work with her because she's been one of the most vocal critics of his work years ago, and it's great that she's come about and changed her views, Professor Tilley said. I think personally, fertilizing the first eggs is doable. I see no hurdles why it cannot be done this year, he added. The important thing is that if you can show you can get ovarian stem cells from human ovary, you then have the potential to do more for fertility preservation. And it's not just the fertility preservation, it's the condition of the woman's body. Once she goes into menopause, the hormonal balance begins to shift. Other things happen: breast cancer, cervical cancer, all kinds of blood pressure problems, heart problems, valve hardening, eyesight, the skin becomes less supple. Fat cells begin to gather underneath the chin and underneath the breasts and around the belly. All this is what you typically see as an old woman. All that goes away non-surgically because the hormone levels can be kept normal by healthy ovaries. You are now breedable up to 70, 80, even 90 years old. Menopause is postponed for decades. Women could stay in the full health and vigor and flower of life until 100 years old. We have all the local ethical approval in place, and we're now looking at the process of the HFEA application. There's a push for us to do it now. She added, I reckon so, because I'll bet you at least half the people on that council are women. Interesting stuff. Well, in the world of seismology, we've also had some news in the last week. A magnitude 5.9 earthquake struck off the coast of Oregon on Wednesday, was followed by a minute later by a smaller earthquake off the coast of Central California. The Pacific Tsunami Warning Center said the quakes were unlikely to trigger a tsunami. The Oregon quake was initially reported as a magnitude 6.2 and the California one a 5.3. Both were later downgraded. It was not immediately known whether the quakes caused any damage or casualties. But a strong earthquake hit Mexico the same day, shaking buildings in the capital and sending people rushing out of offices into the streets, though there were no early reports of major damage. Mexico City Mayor Marcelo Ebrard said on his Twitter account there were no initial signs of serious damage and that key services in the capital, including its subway system and the international airport, were operating normally. There is a nasty crunching sound in my bathroom and everything moved, said Adela Arceo, who was looking after two young children in the central Roma neighborhood of Mexico City. There were no initial reports of casualties. Now, the USGS said the 7.0 quake struck in the western state of Michoacán at a depth of 40.8 miles. Emergency services in Michoacán and in the neighboring state of Guerrero, which had been hit by a series of recent quakes, reported no major problems on Wednesday. Now, as if that wasn't enough, we got Oregon, we got Central California, we got Mexico. We also have the Honolulu-based Tsunami Warning Center said it had not issued a tsunami warning, but staff oceanographer David Walsh noted the quake was close to water, big enough and potentially deep enough to cause one. It was the third major quake to hit Mexico in less than a month. 7.4 magnitude quake struck on March 20th, damaging hundreds of buildings in the southwest, and that was followed by dozens of aftershocks. Not done yet. A massive earthquake struck off the coast of the Indonesian island of Sumatra on Wednesday, same day, triggering a tsunami watch for the Indian Ocean, which was later canceled. The quake struck about 434 kilometers, that's about 270 miles, southwest of Banda Aceh, the capital of Indonesia's Aceh province, and had a magnitude of 8.6. The USGS said it took place at a depth of 23 kilometers. It's about 14 miles, very close to the surface, very close. A second large quake with a magnitude of 8.2 occurred off the west coast of Sumatra about 2 hours later. A second large quake with Gary Gibson from the Seismology Research Center in Melbourne, Australia, said the location of the second quake reduced the possibility of a tsunami. Lots of quakes all over the rim. There were no reports of destruction or deaths. 4 people slightly injured. And so the entire Pacific Rim was rattling, to be sure. Let's go ahead and take a quick break before we go into the third hour. Again, our cell phone is 888-429-5471. That's not the cell phone. That's the main number of the studio. We want you to call in and become part of the program. If you're listening on the conference line, thank you so much. Glad you're out there listening. I just want a couple quick things. Make sure that you know that we can add video to the program. And I just wanted your opinion. If you think it's a good idea, not a good idea, would you like to see the program as well as hear the program on the BBS radio network? please write me, bagnew@x2-radio.com, bagnew@x2-radio.com, and we'll talk about it. Make your suggestions. We'll be back right after this. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming at you.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archer split the tree.
There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century.
Well, I was lying in a burned up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky.
There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio, third hour. I'm so glad that you could join us. Don't forget the Maya 2012 conference is coming up in December. I know it's only April, but it takes a lot of planning to get these things done, even on your level. It's important that you be there because this is ground zero for 2012. It's what we've all been looking for. It's what we're all doing. And some of the world's best speakers are going to be there. I understand that Sting and Carlos Santana are going to be playing a concert at the same venue. It is going to be awesome. Now, thank you so much. Over 200 of you have clicked on the banner. We have that statistic. Very few of you have signed up, though, and I would like to see you all there. You got to see yourself there. You got to make your deposit and plan on being with us. If you don't have a passport or you don't like traveling to foreign countries, no worries. There's another conference called the Pythagoras Conference. You can click on at xsquaredradio.com. If you do so, you'll get $100 off. And there are 50 speakers from all around the world coming to that. And you'll enjoy it. I promise you that. Southern Indiana, it's a gambling resort. So lots going on there. It's a fine, fine venue. And it's within driving distance. That's the fun thing. So join us at the Pythagoras Conference or Maya 2012. And I also wanted to let you know, if you're just joining us, that Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty, my latest book, is now in print. It will be out on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and wherever fine books are sold next week. And you can get it for another 24 hours at alienatednation.com for the pre-publication discounted price of $9.95. You get two things with that. You get the autographed copy and you get the audiobook for free. Of course, if you wait after 24 hours, you can pay $14.95. I'm happy with that. You also get the audiobook with that purchase if you buy from the website. We'll be out there pushing it and talking about it. We want you to talk about it with your friends, too. So we can make this one a good start. My last one made number 29 on Amazon and about the same number on Barnes & Noble. And I would like to make this one a little bit better, just a different genre. There's over 15,000 of you out there that have bought my books, so please grab this one up and give it a read. I guarantee you it will get you moving. Now, lots going on out there, news-wise, so much happening. And, you know, a lot of it is quite moving. I mean, it moves you to action. It makes you think about who you are, what you're doing, why you're here, what you're focused on. Some of the things that that I bring out in this book are quite shocking, and they're very, very current. Yes, we have some Civil War history and some World War II history in there because you need to know where we were, where we are. But we also talk about where we're going, well, who's doing what, how you can get involved, what you can do without really getting out of your house, you know, unless you want to. There's a lot you can do if you are willing to do that. The other thing is that the last chapter in it is called the Home Repair Kit. And there are things that you personally can do in your own home, your own family, your own life that can help you keep it together. I'm going to give you those words of advice now. It'll take about 10 minutes. If you miss something, that's okay. But I think it's so important that you do these things. And you can listen to me or you can not listen to me. It's your choice. But it's also my choice to empower you with this knowledge, because once you have it, then you can know where to stand. You can stand out of the way when the rock falls out of the sky, and you won't have to die. You won't have to live the rest of your life knowing that you should have done something and you didn't know what to do. The first one is, and I've said it on this program before, very slowly, very carefully, not all at once, please, not all at once, no pushing or shoving, get as much cash as you can out of the bank. Just keep it at home. Put it in envelopes, put it in zipper bags, put it in mattresses. Don't leave it at the bank. The second thing that you need to do, and is probably the most important, is to get out of debt. And now, a lot of people say, yeah, but I can't do that. I don't earn enough money. Listen, you've been saving money in a 401k somewhere with your company or with Fidelity or MassMutual or something. Sell it. Pay the 10% hit. Take the money and get yourself out of debt and do it now. Okay? If you have something that you're making payments on and you don't need, put it on eBay. Get yourself out of debt, because if you're not out of debt, you're going to be a slave. You're not going to be able to move. I was talking to the FedEx guy yesterday. He brought some stuff that I had ordered. Nice guy. I had my motorcycle out and I was kind of polishing up. He asked me what year it was. I said, it's a 1996. That's pretty old. That's pretty old. It's a 16-year-old motorcycle. But I keep it in good shape. And he said, you know, I recently had to sell my motorcycle. I said, why? Because the guy's in shape. I mean, he's a FedEx driver. He said, well, you know, I'm 50 years old. And I've never had trouble making my bills. But gas prices have gone up so high and everything's getting higher and higher. Food is higher and utilities and everything's going up, up, up. He said, I can't make ends meet anymore, so I had to sell my bike and pay some bills off. Now, that is where we are. That's where we are. People that have jobs, I mean, to be a FedEx driver is a pretty high-paying job, and I'm sure his wife works too, school teacher, daycare, whatever. She's got a job too. Two jobs, kids, and they can't get by. They're not buying anything new. They're not going out and buying new furniture. They don't have fancy sports cars or anything like that that they're paying on. Just normal, everyday living. The guy had to sell his motorcycle. Now, that's a tragedy. I don't want to see you in that position. It is so much better to simplify and realize that you do not need to be trapped by the physical things of this world. If you have a 401k, don't be like MF Global depositors. These guys were all pretty well-to-do. Not wealthy. We're talking about 10 or 20,000 accounts. Some of them had $1,000 in them. Some had 10,000 in them. That's not killing the world, let me tell you. That's not huge amounts of money. These are average farmer people that were trading. Except at this particular time, they weren't trading. The money was just sitting there in an account, earning a little bit of interest, or maybe not earning any interest. Maybe it was in a money market account. It was in and out, in and out, in and out, but it wasn't at risk. MF Global took it all. They stole it all. At the end of the day, it's probably going to be close to $3 billion, and it's just the tip of the iceberg. Just the tip of the iceberg. The money that you think is in your 401k is going to fall apart like a daisy smack with a nine iron. Pay the 10% and get yourself out of debt. Believe me, getting rid of the debt now, reducing your debt burden, will allow you to earn the same money you're earning now, except you'll have so much more disposable income. And you know what it feels like? Yep, freedom. That's what it feels like. I'm just saying, those are two things that you can do. Put a small 72-hour get together. Store a little bit of food. I recommend dehydrated food or something, MREs or something that'll keep for a long time. You don't have to rotate them in and out. You can pack it up and get out. Don't buy a 55-gallon drum of anything. I don't even recommend buying 5-gallon stuff because you got to pack it. You're going to have to put it in your car, and you're going to have to go somewhere. And you can't take a 55-gallon drum with you, and you won't be able to stay where you are. Mobile food, I would recommend at least a month's supply. A month's supply, okay? That's 90 meals at least. You probably want a couple hundred meals because you're not going to be the only one eating. Okay, you might have to feed other people, neighbors, friends that didn't prepare, that didn't hear this program. A couple hundred meals. There are lots and lots and lots of sources out there. I've had several as affiliates, but you know what? I don't run a charity for affiliates. If they don't pay their commissions, they don't get to advertise on X Squared Radio. So if you have food storage, you're a distributor for food storage stuff or survival stuff, I'd be happy to give you coverage on X Squared Radio and have you let you have access to my listeners as long as you pay me a commission on what's sold. At the end of the day, we got to keep our lights on too. You don't pay, you're going to go fall into ignominy with the others. The point is that you can go to eBay, you can go to Craigslist, all kinds of places, and you can find food storage. Take a spare check. You got one three times a year. You got a fifth week. Take that spare check and buy some food storage. That's the third thing. Store a little bit of water, too. 2-liter bottles are the best because they don't take in the flavors from outside. Don't use milk jugs. Those are terrible. Okay? Don't use polyethylene. Use polyester, okay? The polyester or polypropylene, at least polypropylene, but preferably polyester, the clear 2-liter bottles. Those will keep water for a long time. If you're using tap water, that's fine. You can do that. But if you use distilled water or something like that, put a couple drops, just a couple drops of ordinary bleach in there. Yes, it's chlorinated, but you're going to filter it out anyway because the other thing I want you to buy is a charcoal filter. They're cheap. You can buy them at Walmart or any other local store, or you can buy them from a survival place. Simple silver impregnated charcoal. That's all you need. What that does, you can pour the water through it, strip the chlorine right back off the water, and you've got clean drinking water, which in sometimes in a disaster or in a mobile situation, when you have to move, clean drinking water is hard to come by. And besides, 2-liter bottles, two of them or three of them can easily be put into a book bag, and you've got a water supply. Very, very important stuff. The fourth thing is, you need to have a plan. If you have family or friends, you need to have a network for how to get to them on foot if you have to, a bicycle if you have to. Transportation may not be possible. The roads may be clogged. They may be out. They may be restricted. You know, all the federal highways out there, you got it. They belong to the federal government, and they can issue anytime they want essential services only. That means if you're on the freeway and you are not an essential service, you could be placed under arrest and your vehicle can be impounded, bulldozed right into a ditch. Those freeways were built with federal money expressly for one thing. No, it wasn't to get you to Denver. It was to move troops rapidly across the country. And that's why the federal government can seize control of them at any time. You might have to walk. So, not only are you going to have your 72-hour kit, food storage, and water, but you're also going to have a comfortable, pre-worn pair of shoes. Just take an old pair of tennis shoes or hiking boots and don't throw them away. Put them in the book bag. Put them in the back. Put it in the closet. Forget about it until you need it. When you grab it and head out the door, you got everything you need to stay alive for 72 hours. FEMA won't even know your name if you can take care of yourself. And I've seen the aftermaths of Hurricane Katrina. I was there. I've seen aftermaths of earthquakes in Southern California. I was there. And I've watched on TV how people from tornadoes have to be taken care of, tornado victims have to be taken care of from outside services because they didn't store anything on their own. So be self-reliant. Do those things that I'm advising you to do. They're in the last chapter of the book called The Home Repair Kit, and it's called Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty. Lots of stuff in there that you can take advantage of. Tell your friends and be awakened, my friends. Lots and lots of stuff coming down the pike. You know, recently we had a lot of very, very bad weather. And the interesting thing about the weather is that the National Weather Service issued a deadly weather alert 24 hours before the storm occurred. That's how bad they knew the storm was going to be. And it's only been done once before that I know of. Usually they'll have an early warning system that goes off, you know, some kind of regional or National Weather Service alert that goes off on the radio or television. But that's, you know, a few minutes or sometimes an hour before it occurs. This was 24 hours before it occurred. So just to let you know, weather is doing strange stuff at any moment, at any time. Earthquakes and other things could happen to radically change the security of your situation. So just want you to be keyed into that. These life-threatening storms that are issued well in advance really means times are changing. You know, climate change is upon us. And other changes are upon us. You know, we were talking about the internet earlier about how it being an unfettered, uncircumcised media through which anything, and I mean, it's often been said if it wasn't for pornography, there wouldn't be any internet. Maybe not now, but in the early days, in the early, you know, when high-speed internet was first coming on in the mid-90s, you know, people didn't have email. People didn't, you know, they searched the web for entertainment or, you know, maybe to read papers or stuff like that. But, it, you know, really it was the stuff that you didn't want to see in public that really made the internet, you know, financially possible. But all that has changed. Now we have search engines like Google and Yahoo. We used to have Alta Vista and, you know, different search engines like that. That they're still out there, but they're nothing compared to what they were when they first came out. AOL was by far the largest when it first came out. They didn't know how to monetize it, or they monetized it all wrong, pissed everybody off. Now we have functionality to the internet that young people, old people alike, even small business takes advantage of Twitter and Facebook and things like that. Well, I have a story here. It's, you know, he's 36 years old. He's a billionaire. His name is Sergey Brin. You know him, okay? Yeah, Google. That's right. Sergey Brin says he and Google co-founder Larry Page would not have been able to create their search giant if the internet was dominated by Facebook. It's true. Not that Facebook is this giant juggernaut, but in an interview with The Guardian, Brin warned that there were, and I quote, very powerful forces that have lined up against the open internet on all sides and around the world. I am more worried than I have ever been in the past, he said. It's scary. The threat to the freedom of the internet comes, he claims, from a combination of governments increasingly trying to control access and communication by their citizens. The entertainment industry's attempt to crack down on piracy and the rise of restrictive walled gardens such as Facebook and Apple, which tightly control what software can be released on their platforms. The 38-year-old billionaire whose family fled anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union was widely regarded as having been the driving force behind Google's partial pullout from China in 2010 over concerns about censorship and cyber attacks. He said 5 years ago he did not believe China or any other country could effectively restrict the internet for long. But now says he has been proven wrong. Quote, I thought there was no way to put the genie back in the bottle. But now it seems, in certain areas, the genie has been put back in the bottle. He said he was most concerned by the efforts of countries such as China, Saudi Arabia, and Iran to censor and restrict use of the internet, but warned that the rise of Facebook and Apple, which have their own proprietary platforms and control access to their users, risked stifling innovative innovation and balkanizing the web. There's a lot to be lost, he said. For example, all the information in apps, that data is not crawlable by web crawlers. You can't search it. Brin's criticism of Facebook is likely to be controversial, with the social network approaching an estimated $100 billion flotation. Google's upstart rival has seen explosive growth. It has signed up half of Americans with computer access and more than 800 million members worldwide. Wow, that's market penetration. 50% of Americans with computers are on Facebook, including me. Ooh. Brin said he and co-founder Larry Page would not have been able to create Google if the internet was dominated by Facebook. You have to play by their rules, which are really restrictive, he said. The kind of environment that we developed Google in, the result, the reason that we were able to develop a search engine, is the web was so open. Once you get too many rules, that will stifle innovation. He criticized Facebook for not making it easy for users to switch their data to other services. Facebook has been sucking down Gmail contacts for many years, he said. Brin's comments come on the first day of a week-long Guardian investigation of the intensifying battle for control of the internet being fought across the globe between governments, companies, military strategists, activists, and, of course, hackers. From the attempts made by Hollywood to push through legislation allowing pirate websites to be shut down, to the British government's plan to monitor social media and web use, the ethos of openness championed by the pioneers of the internet and World Wide Web is being challenged on a number of fronts. In China, which now has more internet users than any other country, go figure, the government recently introduced new real identity rules in a bid to tame the boisterous microblogging scene. In Russia, there are powerful calls to rein in a blogosphere. blamed for fomenting a wave of anti-Vladimir Putin protests. It has been reported that Iran is planning to introduce a sealed national internet from this summer. Rikin Patel, co-founder of Avaz, the 14 million strong online activist network, which has been providing communication equipment and training to Syrian activists, echoed Brin's warning. We've seen a massive attack on the freedom of the web. Governments are realizing the power of this medium to organize people, and they are trying to clamp down across the world, not just in places like China and North Korea. We're seeing bills in the United States, in Italy, all across the world. Writing in The Guardian on Monday, outspoken Chinese artist and activist Ai Weiwei says the Chinese government's attempts to control the internet will ultimately be doomed to failure. In the long run, he says, they must understand it is not possible for them to control the internet unless they shut it off. And they can't live with the consequences of that. Amid mounting concern over the militarization of the internet and claims denied by Beijing that China has mounted numerous cyber attacks on U.S. military and corporate targets, he said it would be hugely difficult for any government to defend its online territory. If you compare the internet to the physical world, there aren't any walls between countries, he said. If Canada wanted to send tanks into the U.S., there's nothing stopping them, and it's the same on the internet. It's hopeless to try to control the internet. He reserved his harshest words for the entertainment industry, which he said was shooting itself in the foot, or maybe worse than in the foot. Okay. By lobbying for legislation to block sites offering pirate material. He said the SOPA and PIPA bills championed by the film and music industry would have led to the U.S. using the same technology and criticized China and Iran for using. The entertainment industry failed to appreciate people would continue to download pirated content as long as it was easier to acquire and use than legitimately obtained material. I haven't tried it for many years, but when you go on a pirate website, you choose what you like. It downloads to the device of your choice, and it will just work. And then, when you have to jump through all these hoops to buy legitimate content, the walls created are disincentives for people to buy. Brin acknowledged that some people were anxious about the amount of their data that was now in the reach of U.S. authorities because it sits on Google's servers. He said the company was periodically forced to hand over data and sometimes prevented by legal restrictions from even notifying users that it had done so. He said, "We push back a lot. We were able to turn down a lot of these requests. We do everything possible to protect the data. If we could wave a magic wand and not be subjects to U.S. law, that would be great. If we could be in some magical jurisdiction that everyone in the world trusted, that would be great. We're doing it as well as it can be done." I believe you, Mr. Brin. I believe you. When I was in Egypt with my friends, and a few weeks later, the entire Egyptian youth and many of the middle-aged people jumped into the streets and threw Mubarak out of office. That all happened not because of mouth-to-ear or person-to-person communication. That was a spontaneous thing that had been building for weeks and weeks and weeks, and it took place because of Twitter and Facebook. It took place because of the social networks that they had built inside that country. And guess what? They're back out on the streets today. It's true. Now, our press reports that as Islamists. Islamists are in the streets, and they're not wanting the military to take control of the government. They don't want the Mubarak cronies to take back over the government. So Islamists are in the street. The Islamic Brotherhood is in the streets. Let me tell you something. The only unity that's going on over there is the unity for liberty. They don't want Sharia law. They don't want to cut people's heads off or hands off or any of that stuff. They want to be free. They want to be allow capital forces, free market forces, to work in their community. They want clean drinking water. They want the same thing that everyone else wants: decent housing, clean water, reliable utilities, a monetary system that functions. The only thing that Egypt has to export is natural gas and their antiquities. And that's it. And the Chinese are copying everything that they do. Every statue, every codex, every building has been copied by Chinese and is sold as cheap trinkets all over the country. Nothing is done by Egyptians, because Egyptians find it so difficult to go into business. You can't go to the bank and borrow money. Even if you could, there's no real estate developed for you to be able to do any of that stuff. Only a few people over there are actually successful. The vast majority of the people are not. Our generation is educated and well-read, but the previous generation, the one that's still in power, the previous generation is illiterate, functionally illiterate. And so they only want the same things everybody else wants, and they want to be able to communicate to do that. Those are the forces that are at work out there, and they're the same forces that are at work in this country. All we really want, seriously, all we really want is not a handout from the government. We want the government to get out of the way and let us go to work. Every single time somebody gets an idea and wants to go into work, some government agency is there telling them they cannot do it. They can't have the funding, they can't have the space, they can't have the license, they can't have the permit, and it goes on and on and on, and you know exactly what I'm talking about. And that kind of energy is pervasive all over the planet. And my hat's off to Mr. Brin. I think he's doing a great job. I think Google and Yahoo are both great search engines that allow us, to reach the Library of Alexandria of this planet. It is the greatest library ever assembled, and the amount of publication and discovery that's being done now because of the ready access to data is going to help the human race evolve. It has become our new neural network, and it may actually be the key to peace. All of these tyrants are being toppled one after the other because the people can meet. The people can share their ideas. They know they're not alone. And when they become informed, they become empowered, and they no longer want to sit around the house and take it. They're going to get out of the house, and they're going to do something about it. And if that scares governments, so be it. Now, let's talk about a little bit of government foot stomping that's going on out there. North Korea. Dun, dun, dun. If you ever get a chance to go to South Korea, you should go. There's a people that know how to work. That area just hums. So much electronic activity, so much entrepreneurialism, and so much drive. And they're really, a focused people. And I have great respect for them. But North Korea, I don't know. It's a different story. Recently, this week, the North Korean army had to reduce its minimum height requirement to 4'9". The reason is because their food supply has been so poor for so long that they have permanently stunted the genetic growth pattern of their people. And so now their soldiers are so small. Excuse me. Their soldiers are so small that they had to reduce the minimum height requirement to 4'9". I don't know. I guess you could build smaller airplanes. But the general public will likely never know what caused the North Korean rocket to crash this week. Just a couple of days ago, on April 13th, I know, it was Friday the 13th, North Korea went ahead with the controversial launch of its long-range Unha 3 rocket, despite warnings from the United States and other nations, which viewed the event as a thinly disguised military missile test. The Unha 3 was supposed to deliver an Earth-observing satellite to orbit, according to North Korean officials. But it had a slight problem after takeoff, and it broke apart like a daisy smack with a 9-iron and pitched into the sea shortly after liftoff. While American intelligence officials may already know what went wrong, I wonder why, the rest of us will probably never get the full story, according to Brian Whedon, a technical advisor with the Secure World Foundation and a former orbital analyst with the U.S. Air Force. I doubt they'll even tell the Koreans what went wrong. I think the U.S. military and its allies in the region probably have a good idea of what happened, perhaps more so than the North Koreans, but it's unlikely the public will ever know, Whedon told Space Magazine. The type of technical intelligence data is rarely ever made public. I would think especially since there might be a few fingerprints on it. Funny how those pesky rockets tend to break up shortly after takeoff. Yeah, it just happens, you know. Well, no big deal. We'll send some rice and some aid and some silk and try to help you along there. Can't wait for you to launch another one. Also, you know, the moon is off the table, but Mars, that's on the table. NASA's Mars Program Planning Group, you guessed it, the MPPG, established to assist the agency in developing a new strategy for the exploration of the red planet, has begun analyzing options for the future robotic missions and enlisting the assistance of scientists and engineers worldwide. I think there may be even nuclear-powered drones in this idea pack. NASA is reformulating the Mars exploration program to be responsive to high-priority science goals and the president's challenge of sending humans to Mars in the 2030s. We're moving quickly to develop options for future Mars exploration missions and pathways, said John Grunsfeld, an astrophysicist, five-time space shuttle astronaut, and associate administrator for NASA's Science Mission Directorate at the agency's headquarters in Washington. As part of this process, community involvement, including international, is essential for charting the new agency-wide strategy for our future Mars exploration efforts. Grunsfeld leads the agency-wide Mars program reformulation effort along with William Gerstenmaier, associate administrator for the Human Exploration and Operations Directorate, Chief Scientist Waleed Abdelati, and Chief Technologist Mason Peck. In February, Grunsfeld named veteran aerospace engineer Orlando Figueroa to lead the MPPG. In March, the group established an initial draft framework of milestones and activities that will include options for missions and sequences, bridging the objectives of NASA's science, human exploration, and operations and technology. Some of the craft that they're putting together to go to Mars are really quite amazing. Little helicopters with six different blade sets on them so they can take off and land and take samples and charge their batteries up and take off and land and take samples again. Others will stay in low or high altitude flight for months and months at a time and take a very, very low level photography and air samples. The new strategy will also be designed to maintain America's critical technical skills developed over decades to achieve the highest priority science and exploration objectives. We know, for one thing, he who controls the moon or controls space also controls the Earth. So there are also two NASA satellites, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and Mars Odyssey, orbiting Mars and returning unprecedented science data and images. In August, NASA will land the Mars Science Laboratory Curiosity on, you know, there's Opportunity and Spirit. One of those, I think it's Opportunity, has assumed room temperature. The solar panels finally gave out or the batteries wouldn't charge up anymore. But the other little robot, Spirit, is still running and still sending data. What they do often with it is they turn the camera straight up, looking at the sky at night. And they just wait for the sun to come up the next day, charge up the solar panels, but they turn it straight up so the camera can actually look at the stars from Mars. Now, that's cool. I mean, because the orbiter doesn't have the ability to see. It only has the ability to receive signals and to boost them and send them back to Earth. But Spirit has a camera on board, and so it can actually lean back and look up into the sky at night. And so we get a perspective of space from Mars. It's just an interesting aspect, different things that they come up with for this little rover that has outlived its design by many years. And the folks down at Caltech are having a blast with that one. Anyway, Curiosity is a roving science laboratory. It will assess whether Mars was in the past or present an environment able to support life. In 2013, NASA will launch the Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution Orbiter, the first mission devoted to understanding the Martian upper atmosphere. One of the things that we know about Mars is that it does not have a magnetosphere, and so it doesn't effectively, on a planet-wide basis, reroute solar radiation. Now, it is an orbit that's larger than Earth's orbit around the sun. We are about 93 million miles from the sun, and Mars is about 140 million miles from the sun. It's also smaller, so it doesn't absorb as much energy from the sun. It would be quite a bit colder. It doesn't have as much gravity, about half the gravity of Earth, and so it can't contain an atmosphere. It's easily stripped away by the solar wind. But it does have an atmosphere, even though it's about 1/100th of what our atmosphere is at sea level. It still has wind. It still has clouds. And so there is an atmosphere. We realize that maybe in the deep valleys, it may be possible to sustain life, high-altitude life on Mars. It is also possible that underneath the surface of Mars, life could be sustained. You would be out of the way of all that shortwave radiation from the sun, you know, all that stuff under 350 nanometers, which we call germicidal radiation, which we don't get on this planet, not much anyway, otherwise you wouldn't be able to go out in the sun at all, and there wouldn't be any bacteria or algae or one-celled animals out there feeding the rest of life on the planet. Also, plant photosynthesis wouldn't work very well because it just doesn't take germicidal radiation very well. It takes a certain wavelength of light for photosynthesis to occur, and that does it quite well on Earth. It's one of the reasons plants are green is because of the chlorophyll. And also, as luck would have it, green absorbs more infrared energy from the sun. So it's able to, especially in cold weather, to maintain life instead of freezing hard like a rock. And we're not sure what under the surface of Mars is like. We don't know what kind of volcanic activity there was on Mars before, and we don't know if those volcanic vents and caves and things like that are accessible. But it would be nice to get data back about that instead of, you know, being able to crawl around a 1 mile diameter field on Mars and say we know about the whole planet. I mean, imagine if Opportunity were to land on Earth, for instance, and the only place it crawled around was Death Valley. I mean, you'd have a completely different idea of what Earth was like, sort of like a blind man feeling the elephant's tail and trying to give a description. Just not enough information. And that's kind of where we're at. We're getting information from the sky, from overhead, but it's not the same as being down on the ground, you know, being able to sift the soil through your hands. We're excited about the program. And one of the things that I talk about in the book in a chapter called One Small Step in the book Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty, is in that chapter we talk about the proposal to stop beating our plows into weapons and do the reverse and reassume our role as explorers. Excuse me while I take some grapefruit juice. Somewhere along the line, the race needs to overcome the primal urge to grab up the tribal flag and race across the misty tundra to hack our neighbors apart. Now, we do it a little more dispassionately now. We don't have somebody in paint riding up and down on a horse or a motorcycle whipping the troops up into some grand frenzy before they, you know, charge across to be disemboweled. We can sit them in front of a computer screen where they don't even have to look at people. They can just look at infrared dots on a page. They can count the statistics, match it with the weapon set that they have and the various drone that they're flying, move the joystick around, get the orders, and remove the dots from the screen. It's rather not like warfare. We've gotten to the point now where that's what the enemy is, and you've already heard tonight in the program that even if we're just fitting the pattern of someone who could be thinking about committing a crime, that's what the entire surveillance system, data acquisition, data analysis, and database management systems are designed to do, to catch terrorists who are not profiled by traditional means. They're profiled by other means, by what you buy and where you live and what kind of music you listen to and what kind of food you eat and what kind of religion you are and what kind of sexual orientation you are. Oh, yes, I forgot about one more thing. What political party you belong to. What school you went to, what professor you had when you were in that school, whether or not you ever owned a weapon, whether or not you ever had military service. You see, all this stuff fits into a database, and they write programs that generate most likely to commit a crime or most likely to think about committing a crime, which is most of you. Oh, yeah, there's some crime that you're thinking about right now. Yeah. Every time you drive down the freeway at 11 miles an hour over the speed limit, looking at that horizon, trying to say, oh, yeah, I can see 6-7 miles ahead. I know the radar can't reach that far. I'm a little bit behind schedule. Or, hey, I'm not behind schedule, but I like driving fast. You're thinking about it. All that stuff, every pattern like it. You think it's too much to handle? You think it's too much to crunch? It's not. They're gathering all the data. They're analyzing all the data. It's going into a database, and it's being profiled by very complex algorithms written by who knows who. And that data is being used against you or against your neighbor or against somebody who's thinking about coming to this country, or against somebody who's not even born yet. And that's where we are. So it isn't conspiracy theory, it's conspiracy fact. And if I guess you're not doing anything wrong, you have nothing to worry about. How many times have we heard those words? You know, Benjamin Franklin once said, you cannot trade liberty for security, because if you do, the time will come when you have neither one. He also said, or maybe it was Jefferson, a government that can give you everything also has the ability to take everything. I think we're there, folks. I think we're in the age of the agency government. And the agency government has become its own government, and it's consuming everything. And you can do something about it. You have a few months to get informed, to get registered, and do your thing. You have the ability to save this country, to save your community, your state, and possibly even the world. You didn't think so, but you do. Maybe that's the reason you're here. Maybe one of the incredible things about being alive on the planet at this time, resonating with the planet, resonating with the other beings on this planet, it takes a lot of energy and a lot of planning to get here. You're here. And if you think your goal is to fill up your garage with the most toys before you die, I think you need to do some soul searching, because there's another purpose. That purpose is resonating in you somewhere. It's down there. Otherwise, you wouldn't be listening to this program. And if you take the advice, you know, that we give on this program, that I bring to you, that's fine. If you don't, that's fine too, but at least you're empowered. At least we're free to say so. At least we're free to think it. At least we have the liberty in this country to become anything we want to be, as long as you're smart enough to get over, around, or through all the regulations. You still have the freedom to do it. It's a challenge. Challenge is what is the purpose of life. If there was no challenge, it wouldn't be heaven. It would be hell. So, give that a little thought, and we'll see you next week on April 22nd. We have about 10 minutes before the top of the hour. My producer likes to have a little bit of time to get the next host on, and I could use it as well. Got to get ready for an international call. So, have a wonderful week. Be productive. Help others see the good in them, and do your best. That's all I can ask. That's all I ever ask. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio.
It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.